I'm Dan Roderick, and this is Midday Friday. Today on the show, Maryland politics. The progressive activists who work to get a minimum wage increase from the General Assembly aren't satisfied with $10.10 an hour by 2018. They don't believe Maryland is true blue and are setting out to elect more progressives to office. Charlie Carter, director of the new Maryland Working Families Organization, joins us this hour. Up front, political analysts Barry Raskavar and Melissa Deckman assess Wednesday night's Democratic gubernatorial debate and the damage done to John Cardin's campaign for attorney general by the revelation in The Sun that he missed 75% of House committee votes as a delegate from Baltimore County to Annapolis. Midday Friday starts after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. Open phone lines this hour to get your reaction to Maryland's first Democratic gubernatorial debate. It was cablecast Wednesday night over Maryland Public Television. If you watched, we'd like to hear your thoughts about Douglas Gansler, Heather Mazier, and Anthony Brown. Did any of them impress you as Maryland's next governor? 410-662-8780 is our number to call in for live talk. Midday's email address, midday@wypr.org. Also, The Sun reported this week that John Cardin, a Democratic candidate for attorney general, missed nearly 75% of House committee votes as a delegate from Baltimore County to Annapolis during the 2014 legislative session. John Cardin yesterday expressed remorse for missing three-quarters of his committee votes, but said the votes he missed generally weren't close and that he needed to spend time with his pregnant wife and young daughter. What do you think about that? 410-662-8780. John Cardin will be joining us for a few minutes during this hour to talk some more about that. He put out a statement on it yesterday. We'll talk about it with Barry Raskavar of Political Maryland and Melissa Deckman of Washington College in just a few minutes. Later in the show, we'll hear from the leader of a new organization that thinks Maryland isn't blue enough, that getting a minimum wage increase from the General Assembly to $10.10 an hour by 2018 should not have been such a challenge in a state supposedly as progressive as Maryland. Charlie Carter will be here soon to talk about Maryland Working Families, an offshoot of the New York-based Working Families Party that was key in rallying voters to elect New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. That's coming up later on in the show. First, we take a look at the campaigns for governor and attorney general with our guest Barry Raskavar, longtime observer of Maryland politics, who now blogs at politicalmaryland.com. His commentary also appears online at MarylandReporter.com. Barry, welcome back to the show. Nice to see you.
Hey, great to be here, Dan.
Joining us by phone today is Melissa Deckman, chair of the Political Science Department, and the Lewis L. Goldstein, professor of public affairs at Washington College in Chestertown. Melissa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Dan. Glad to be here.
Let's get first impressions. This is Friday. The debate was Wednesday night. Didn't get a chance to talk to you, Barry or Melissa, until now. So, Barry, your impressions of that the gubernatorial debate?
Well, if you're going to look for a winner, I think the winner was really the voting public or those who tuned in to watch, because for the first time you were able to see all three candidates together and listen to all three of them. None of them put on a strong enough performance to say they were winners, but at the same time, none of them put on such a miserable performance that they were losers. Mm-hmm. So I think this really kicks off the meat of the campaign for the next 6 weeks.
Melissa, we've been hearing so much about the undecided voter this year. I mean, lots of undecided. The St. Mary's College poll was the most recent affirmation of that showed, I think, 52 or 53% of voters in the Democratic side undecided. So given what Barry just said, is that going to help anybody make up their mind? Did the debate help anyone make up their mind?
You know, I don't think there was a clear-cut winner necessarily from Wednesday night's debates. I agree with Barry, and then I think all three candidates did a pretty good job. If I were to rank order the performances, though, I think Heather Mazier was slightly stronger than the other two candidates because I think she stayed on message and gave a good idea of what her values are and what her policy proposals would be. I think the weakest performance was probably Anthony Brown because he had an opportunity to really cement his lead and maybe to build on it because I think he's still the favored person in front. I think it's still his race to lose. But I felt that his attacks on Gansler were very much ineffective, and he didn't really, he wasn't very specific about what his goals for Maryland are. He kept referring to these vague five-point plans I have on my website, and that's not really, I think, very helpful for the average viewer. But along with Barry, I would say I think that viewers got a good sense of how the candidates are different, and they're very different in terms of their style, in terms of their priorities, and so I think it's a good kickoff for the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, well, I think that from a journalist's perspective, the favorite here would be Doug Gansler, because he is prone to say anything at any time, which is a journalist's delight.
The political
establishment clearly favors Anthony Brown. It's more the status quo, and Heather Mazur is a sharp change, going in a totally different direction. And I think voters have a right to be confused here, because this is really a weak field compared to other gubernatorial years. I mean, you got to go back a long time before you find a governor who has such little in the way of true qualifications as the ones we have running this year.
410-662-8780. I put out that number again because I would really like to hear from anyone who made up their mind based on Wednesday night's debate. First of all, did you watch the debate? There was some controversy about that. You know, it was handled by a Washington TV station. For a time, we didn't think we'd get it in the Baltimore area, but Maryland Public Television did pick it up. Did you watch the debate? Were you undecided before the debate as a Democratic voter, and did you make up your mind by the end of the debate, or are you going to need another, I don't know, four or five debates to make up your mind? We don't have that much time. It's like 6 weeks now, or maybe 7 weeks. It's June 24th is the primary.
It's going to be another month before we have the second debate, Brown has already backed out on the third debate. So, there's not going to be much for voters to judge by, except TV and radio commercials, which are pretty thin so far.
And I think that relying just on the ads is going to be it's going to be very bad for Heather Mazur, because she's the only candidate to accept public funding, and she's really lags in terms of fundraising.
Oh, yeah, she's way behind. I mean, Brown and Gansler each are posting $6-plus million right now, Barry.
Before it's over, Brown and Gansler could well spend close to $15 million just on their advertising. And Mazur is just, I think, going to be left in the dust. That's one of the reasons. The other reasons is she doesn't have much establishment support, if you want to call it that. She has supporters, but... she's the third candidate in the race. Now, surprises have happened before. Harry Hughes is a prime example.
Harry Hughes, 1978.
So, yeah. And this is a year where voters are unclear as to what direction they want to go.
Let's listen to a little bit of the debate. This debate gave Douglas Gansler certainly the first opportunity to confront Anthony Brown on the rollout of Maryland's health insurance exchange. Here's some of that, what Gansler had to say about that.
The lieutenant governor for a number of years has touted that he is in charge of the Affordable Care Act rollout. In fact, right now, if you look on his website, it says that Maryland has led the country in the Affordable Care Act rollout. The Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, Senator Mikulski, and many others have called it a national disaster. I think the lieutenant governor is the only person that believes it's been a success. We're actually 45th in the country in terms of people enrolled. So that's relatively delusional.
Relatively delusional. And later, I think he used the word unmitigated disaster, which I took some exception to, because it was a disaster, but they mitigated it since then. Got a lot of people. It cost more money, but they got a lot more people signed up. Does this work? Does this fly? Melissa, I would like to hear from you. Does this work as a campaign issue for Gansler?
Potentially, yes. You know, and one area of weakness I felt that that Brown showed was really a poor response to that in handling that question. I say this because I still think Brown is likely to win the nomination, and this is going to be one of the biggest issues that comes up in the fall's campaign. And so he needs to come up with a better, more compelling message. He sort of took responsibility, but he sort of folded it into a larger, well, there were problems, and I was part of an effort to change it. But I felt his answer was not very satisfactory. But I do think it's largely the biggest weakness that Brown faces in this campaign is dealing with that disastrous rollout.
Yeah, it's going to be up to Gansler to frame that particular issue much more sharply so that voters get it, that not only was it a disaster, it's indicative of what you might get if you vote for Anthony Brown. He hasn't delivered that message strongly enough in ways that voters react.
I wonder if it works because so many people have signed up for health insurance in Maryland since then. I mean, it was a disaster. So you can keep saying, yes, our website didn't work for a long time. It's costing us more money. It cost us more money as taxpayers to get people signed up. But, you know, 300,000 people insurance that didn't
before. But 200 and some thousand of those are people who are automatically switched to Medicaid.
Agree.
And the others, most of them signed up, but only after huge amounts of problems. And they're probably mad as heck at somebody as a result.
Okay. And so, I think the other problem, too, I mean, it could be that, you know, as we learn more about the national trends in terms of the Affordable Care Act, maybe the momentum will swing slightly more in Anthony Brown's favor if he's the nominee. But in general, there's this sense that no one really knows what happened with the exchange, that the O'Malley administration is being very secretive about all that went down. And there's indications, right, that a report that will analyze what went wrong isn't going to be coming out until after the general election, conveniently enough, for right. Anthony Brown. So I think that Gansler needs to maybe talk more about the process as opposed to the outcome.
Yeah, but Gansler has a very difficult task in front of him. He's got to be sharply critical of Anthony Brown and his role in the healthcare rollout, and critical of the titular leader of the Democratic Party, Martin O'Malley, without alienating the Democrats, right, who have voted twice for O'Malley.
And without sounding like a Republican who's gleeful over the problems with Obamacare.
Right. So it's a delicate balancing act. He hasn't figured it out yet. He's only got 6 weeks. So Brown, it's still his to lose.
Let's get our callers, our listeners involved in this with phone calls. 410-662-8780. Did the debate help you make up your mind? Lisa, we'll go to you. Lisa, thanks for calling Midday.
Hello, Dan. Hello, everybody. Just real quick to say that I think Heather will probably come out as the most sincere and honest of politicians in this race. And I don't mean honest versus crooked. I mean honest as in sincere. And I do believe she will do what she says she's going to do. Having said that, because she's running such an honest campaign and a straight-up campaign, she doesn't have as much big money behind her as the other two guys. And unfortunately, not a lot of people are hearing her and seeing her for what she really is. And the other night, I felt she looked like the mother in the middle of the two fighting boys. And to be honest with you, for some people, it's a little bit more important than that. So if Mr. Gansler and Mr. Brown could actually just stick to the facts and stick to politics, that'll be great. Because people are getting very tired of he said, she said, he said, he said. It's very boring. And I live in an area where we just found out Govan's has a 65% electoral turnout. That's massive. And so the person who wins Baltimore City is the person who's going to actually take the governorship, or at least the nomination, excuse me.
Lisa, let me hear from Barry and Melissa. I appreciate your comments. But what about her last comment there?
Well, I think she's got to look at the location of where Democrats live in Maryland, because the votes are really in Prince George's and Montgomery counties. In this particular race, though, because you have Gansler and Brown coming from those jurisdictions, and Mizier also, the pivotal jurisdiction could well turn out to be Baltimore County. You know, it's the third largest jurisdiction in the state, and it has a tendency to not be as knee-jerk liberal as some of the other jurisdictions are in the urban center. It's going to be very interesting as to who turns out, because it's such an early primary. And it could be a very, very low turnout, and that could determine the race as to who gets their votes out.
And, you know, it's with so many, I think, you know, over half of Maryland primary Democratic voters undecided, it's still, you know, largely winnable by all three. I do think Anthony Brown, again, still is the front runner. Getting back to Mizier, though, and her strategy to be positive, I think that actually will work to her advantage because, you know, she deliberately tried to, and in fact, she was goaded by some of the reporters and by David Gregory to try to be negative, to kind of cast blame, for example, on the health care. And she said, you know, essentially she wants to look beyond casting blame and to kind of look towards solutions. But, you know, I think that it's important to realize that women voters, especially studies have shown, really are turned off by negative campaign attack ads and negative campaigning. And so I think her decision to go positive is probably a smart one. I don't think this is her year. I think that she's basically will come out of this looking at like a good candidate, like someone who has got some good ideas. But I don't think she's going to win it this year. I think she's too progressive for most Maryland voters. And I think that many voters will have an eye toward the electorate in the fall and to kind of make sure that electability is something that's important that they keep in mind when they're voting this June.
Since we're talking about Heather Mazur, let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say during the debate Wednesday night. This is on her position on the legalization of marijuana.
Our marijuana prohibition laws have been a failure. They have been enforced with racial bias. African Americans and whites in our state use marijuana with the exact same frequency, but African Americans go to jail 3 times more often. That's why I fought for decriminalization this session. We're not putting 23,000 people in jail anymore because of their nonviolent possession of this drug. We're not spending $280 million a year on the incarceration, detention, and court costs associated with this. But if we legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana, not only are we bringing in a new revenue source that I dedicate to paying for a universal pre-K program, but we would also be sending an important message about the fact that this is a substance that is arguably less harmful to the body than alcohol and tobacco. And for adults, it should be treated the same way.
Barry?
Yeah, I think that up until her defense of proposing to legalize marijuana, she was on firm ground. But you get on very, very weak turf when you start talking about the fact, well, this does less harm to the body than alcohol and smoking. You know, it's interesting because I was reading an article, Columbia University Magazine, on this very thing, and they have a marijuana research center up there that's been around for decades. Hmm. And, you know, the academics who have done the research up there was saying, it does enormous marijuana use, regular marijuana use, does enormous harm to the body, and is an issue that really has not been discussed. And I think Brown and Gansler both made the point that they're not in favor of legalization at this stage. And Gansler even said Governor Jerry Brown is opposed strongly as well because of the potential health effects and the potential social effects. This is a huge question mark that nobody is really talking about.
And Melissa, I just want to ask you this about marijuana. It's not clear, well, I guess it's clear from the Colorado vote and Washington State vote how some voters feel about this, a majority of voters feel about it in those particular states.
Right.
It's still not clear how this plays in politics in a political campaign within, right? I mean, we understand it as an issue, as a referendum question, but as a dynamic in a political campaign, a gubernatorial campaign, it's just not clear how this works.
No, exactly. And building on what Barry just said, you know, studies show that the medical effects of marijuana are the worst on teenagers and young adults because their brains are still developing. And so that, of course, arguably would be the group that would probably like to see marijuana legalized above anyone else. So there is the medical issues are still, I think, up in the air. And I think that Americans, the trend has been for more support for the legalization of marijuana over time or the last decade. And part of that, though, is really driven by what Heather Mazur said in the beginning of her statement that you had in the clip. Because essentially, you know, the prosecution of those who violate marijuana laws has been incredibly racially biased. It's a huge cost on the system. And the Maryland General Assembly this year passed a decriminalization bill that had really large levels of support. It was largely partisan, you know, more Democrats, obviously, than Republicans. But that has, she's on much firmer ground, as Barry says, in terms of public opinion. But moving beyond that, and in fact, she's been a big advocate for regulating and legalizing marijuana. Her bill, she didn't put forward a bill this session to do that, or if she did, it didn't go very far. But essentially, her policy has been known as pots for tots, right, because she wants to legalize marijuana and spend it on early childhood. That is a very progressive policy that I don't think most Marylanders are ready at this point to take into account. And so she is on some sort of unheralded ground in terms of campaigning, getting back to your question. And I think that's one of the areas in which she does not have a lot of support for, even within a Democratic primary electorate. 10 years from now, this might be a different story. And if we find that in Colorado and other states that have legalized it, if there is this huge revenue to be gained from it, then I think that, you know, it might, Maryland voters might find that more appealing eventually. But I think at this point, Maryland voters are going to be likely suspect of this very issue.
Melissa Deckman of Washington College on the phone with us. Barry Raskovar, Political Maryland, in the studio with us. We'll take our first break here. And a note to our listeners who have called in and want to comment on the gubernatorial campaign, the gubernatorial debate from the other night. Please stay on the line. We'll get to your calls when we get back. And we'll also be speaking with John Cardin, Democratic candidate for Attorney General, who the Baltimore Sun reported this week missed nearly 75% of his House committee votes and has put out a statement in response to his absenteeism in Annapolis. So we'll get to talk with him for a few minutes when we get back. So sit tight, everybody. We'll be right back. It's Midday Friday. Welcome back. Dan Rodericks here, Midday Friday. We're going to go right back to the gubernatorial campaign in a moment. I just wanted to spend a few minutes here with Delegate John Cardin, who's called in to our show to talk about this story in the newspaper this week in The Sun about his attendance at House Committee on which he served in Annapolis as a delegate from Baltimore County. The Sun story saying that he missed nearly 75% of his committee votes this year. He put out an explanation for that yesterday and joins us now on Midday. Delegate Cardin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan and Melissa and Barry. It's always great to hear you guys.
Delegate Cardin is a candidate for Attorney General in the Democratic primary in June, on June 24th. So 75%, you missed 75% of your votes on the committee. You say it's because you had to spend time at home. Other people, including your opponents, say, well, that's no excuse. Everybody's facing those situations down here.
Let me try and give you very quickly some context. First of all, I certainly regret missing votes as whenever we try and do have multiple requirements, you know, I regret the ability not to do everything. But I've been present for both committee and House floor votes, by the way, over 90% of the time during my legislative career, with the exception of this past session, which was just committee votes. And as you're aware, but maybe your listeners aren't, the committee work is done. I was in Annapolis every single day. I spent more than 1,000 hours, I calculated it, in Annapolis, drafting up bills, working up bills, amending, and making sure that we got the job done. I missed 9 voting sessions, and the majority of those were late in the evening. I talked to my chairman the first day of session when I told her that I have a pregnant wife. I wanted to make sure that we actually took care of all of our matters. And because my chairman, we've always consistently had our votes being done during the day, the work day, we scheduled our extracurricular personal activities for the evenings. And so that's just the fact of the matter. She knew it. We made sure that I was not going to impact any votes. In fact, of the 119 votes that were taken in my committee, let alone the all the other votes, but 119 votes that I missed in committee, the vast majority of them were unanimous. So, I mean, look, am I sorry? Of course I am. Do I have to tend to my commitments at home?
Well, absolutely. John, excuse me, Delegate Cardin, what are you sorry about then? It sounds like you're building you're trying to make a strong rationale for why you missed votes. None of the votes were close. You worked it out with the committee chairman. You have responsibilities at home. So what exactly are you apologizing for?
Well, I regret having not being able to do everything, not having more hours in a day. What I am thrilled about is that I had the most successful session of my career, having passed things like Brianna's Law, making children lifesavers, trying to we did a Good Samaritan drug policy reform, anti-patent troll legislation, criminalizing revenge porn, online sexual harassment. I was thrilled to be able to be part of that. What was an anomaly this year is that many of our committee votes happened later in the evening when I had a predetermined things that I had to get to make sure the health and well-being of my family was taken care of. And I am sorry that I can't do it all, but I feel as if I made commitments, and I am proud of the commitment I've made to the state and to my family.
Okay. Delegate Cardin, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Delegate John Cardin with his comments about the Sun story this week that he missed nearly 75% of his votes at the influential Ways and Means Committee of the House of Delegates. You heard his explanation there. So, Barry, this story's been out for a couple of days. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, it was a huge strategic blunder by John Cardin to start missing these voting sessions. He knows better than anyone, because he's been down in Annapolis so long, that this is where the sausage gets made. And if you're not there, you're not really fulfilling your responsibilities. And this is an issue that is going to dog him for the next 6 weeks.
What about his point that they calculated that none of these votes were going to be close and that he wasn't needed? What about that calculation?
Well, yeah, if he makes that calculation, then all of a sudden half the committee is going to make that same calculation. You know, that's not a reason. It really isn't.
And Melissa, what about the reasons stated, spending time at home, a pregnant wife, a young daughter?
You know, I think that a lot of people will be sympathetic to the issues of work-family balance. And I think, in fact, we're having this national conversation about these issues currently in American politics. And I think it's good to have that conversation. However, he was elected to do a job. You know, the General Assembly meets for an intensive 90-day session. And the expectation is that you're there from morning to night, at least for this period of time. And I think that missing 75% of the votes, you know, 10%, I can understand. People get sick. But 75%, that's a big problem. And I understand he's trying to sort of couch it by saying that, well, these really weren't important. The decisions wouldn't, the outcome wouldn't have been different. And I can understand that. But I think he's quite vague on the actual reasons for missing. You know, it's a fine line. I understand that people want to protect their privacy. But at the same time, he chose to run for this public office. And he needs, I think, to do a better job explaining the source of missing the votes. And as Barry indicated, you know, he chose to run for Attorney General this year, and he didn't have to make that decision right now. And so I think that was sort of odd, the timing of all of this, in comparison to sort of his record in previous years. So I think he needs to do some more explaining, and I think it's definitely a political liability.
410-662-8780 is our number here if you'd like to comment on the John Cardin matter. Also, we'll go back to the gubernatorial campaign. I have some emails to read, some tweets. Back to that subject of Heather Mazier. We've got a tweet here at Midday WYPR that she seemed to have been left out of the debate. There was a stretch there when David Gregory, the host, was pretty much getting Brown and Gansler to go at it and leaving Heather Mazier alone there in the middle. Several people have made that comment on Twitter.
Yeah, I think that's an unfair comment. It did happen, but the reason it happened, it is that the ground rules had been established that when David Gregory felt one candidate was attacking another candidate, he'd give the other candidate a chance to respond. And since it was Brown going after Gansler and vice versa, and Mazier was just standing there, that's the way the ball game worked, and maybe it worked to her advantage.
Here's some of the exchange between Anthony Brown and Doug Gansler on that issue that came up about Doug Gansler and his son's beach party last year down in Delaware.
We are the role models to discourage underage drinking. You did a public service announcement, but then found yourself in the middle of not one, two, or three, but literally hundreds of teenagers underage drinking. And what I would have done as a parent, and I too am a parent, my 19-year-old daughter sitting right here in the audience,
okay,
I would have stopped the party and made sure that every child got home safely.
All right, take 30 seconds, Attorney General.
Well, as much as I appreciate the Lieutenant Governor lecturing me on my parenting skills, I would like to talk about the military question that you just asked.
You know, I thought that Gansler did pretty well there, because this is a negative for him, and Brown sort of helped him turn it into a bit of a positive. I don't know many people who like being lectured about how they raise their kids.
No, and he also said later, he said, we parent on the fly.
Right, yeah.
Right. And I think every parent identifies with that, too. That this is not an easy job. He also said that, look, my kid is now in college, and we're worried about him at parties like this in college. But in this case, what is left out of the discussion is that this was a chaperoned event, And you couldn't just say kids go home because they were staying there overnight.
Right. And there were parents,
for the weekend.
And there were
the
parents
week.
On duty during the week. They had worked this all out and organized.
Yes.
Melissa, do you have any comment about that?
I'm still not convinced that Doug Ansler is going to overcome that. And part of it is, you know, those pictures are horrible. And I have a feeling they will appear again somehow in some ad before June. And it really shows a lack of judgment, I think, in Ansler's situation. Because he's the top law the law enforcement official in the state of Maryland. So I have trouble coming to grips with that. However, having said that, I do think that Doug Gansler handled it very well at the debate. And you're right, no one likes to be lectured about their parenting skills. And I think it was a humanizing moment for Doug Gansler. And so we'll have to see how it plays out. I think it went about as well as it could be expected from Doug Gansler. But I'm not convinced that this issue, combined with his other gaffes, you know, the idea of this entitlement of having state troopers skip in front of other drivers and the gaffe he made about Brown's military service, I'm not sure that he can overcome that.
Melissa and Barry, here's a tweet from Jen Jen on the subject of John Carden. She said, I wonder what the public would say if a woman had used John Carden's excuse that I had to be home. Okay. Let's see. We'll go to Anne in Baltimore, wanted to comment on the debate. And we asked whether you had made up your mind on who to vote for June 24th based on the debate. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
What did you want to say about this?
Well, first of all, I want to thank MPT for carrying the debate and all those people who, I think, complained about it and made it possible. Because I haven't really known too much about any of the candidates, and most of their ads don't really help. So I was very happy to watch the debate, and I ended up thinking that Heather Mazur was closer in giving details of her policy hopes, and she had more specific information about how she would pay for things. The other two, Gansler and Brown, believed in all this same stuff. You know, my beliefs match with all three of them, but they didn't explain how they're going to do all the things they want to do. And Heather Mazur was more specific, and she also has a plan for how to pay for things.
So Anne, did you made up your mind, it sounds like.
For her. The other thing I wanted to say was that I think it was Maryland Morning. I was listening to it one day when Sheila Cast had, I believe there's a Republican candidate named Ron George. I was very impressed with him. I'm not a Republican, but I was impressed with the whole way he approached. He believes in the same things that I believe in. He just had a little bit different way of getting there. But
okay, Ann, thank you very much. It sounds like Ann made up her mind about who to vote for in the Democratic primary. I got Heather Mazur from her on that.
Yes, apparently she'd like to vote in both primaries.
Yeah, sounds like. John writes in to say, I found Doug Gansler's reporting of the claim that only four people signed up on the health insurance exchange a bit odd. I signed up in October last year. I hadn't heard back from the exchange until days before the January 1st deadline. But was I really one of only four signups?
He's basing that on an early Washington Post story. And that's how he substantiates his claim. He hasn't done any update since then. So, yeah, it just sounds good.
Because at some point, only four people had used the website to sign up.
Right.
Is that right?
Well, look, very few people were able to use the website. And that's what caused a lot of the frustrations.
I do like Heather Mazur, he says, but don't think she can beat David Craig in the general election. David Craig, of course, the Harford County executive, who is a candidate for the Republican nomination. I'll probably still vote for her. I think Anthony Brown is too weak. Doug Gansler would be a fun governor like William Donald Schaefer. and Fran writes in to say, I was very disappointed in the news coverage on WBAL the day after the debate. The only topics were what Gansler and Brown had to say about each other and if they were telling the truth. This is important, but Heather Mazur was not even mentioned. I think she's the only candidate who offers an alternative to more of the same. Pat in Baltimore with a comment on the John Carden absenteeism situation. Hello, Pat.
Hi there. Listening to John Carden today, I was beginning to think about all the hardworking folks who don't have the luxury of missing 75% of their work responsibility to take care of their family. I don't know what his family situation is, but I know there are many, many people who do a lot of juggling to balance family and work. But I doubt they would keep their job if they missed so much time.
Okay, very good point.
Right. Senator Brian Frosch made the same point that when he was in the House of Delegates, he missed the birth of his child because of work in Annapolis. It's a responsibility. And, you would think, especially in an election year, that Delegate Carden would have made more of an effort to show up for his committee votes.
Let's go to Thurman in Bel Air to get Thurman's comments on the debate and the gubernatorial election. Hi, Thurman.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to say?
I'm undecided. I really appreciate seeing the debate. That was great. But I'm really undecided at this point. I'm very disappointed, actually, in the Democratic field, what's available. I know this comment has been made before, but I'm disappointed in Mr. Brown and also in Mr. Gensler. I did really appreciate Ms. Mazier's comment that we're locking up way too many African-American young people. I spent the last 7 years of my career at the Hickey School, and I absolutely know that's true. But I just wish we had a stronger field to choose from. And I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I certainly hope I don't end up voting Republican this year.
Hmm. That's another issue we'll have to get to another day. How this shapes up as far as the general election goes, if the Democrats continue to battle it out like this, and there's a lot of people shrugging about who they're voting for, sort of meh, attitude toward all the candidates, and then the general election comes. This could be a more interesting year than we thought it would be.
Well, history tells us the only way a Republican wins in Maryland is to have a pretty sharp split within the Democratic Party. We don't have an indication yet that that's going to happen, but depending on the outcome June 24th, then we can talk about it.
Okay. And Melissa Deckman, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Melissa Deckman joins us from time to time here on Midday to talk politics. She's chair of the Political Science Department and the Lewis L. Goldstein Professor of Public Affairs at Washington College in Chestertown. And Barry Raskovar. Look for Barry's writings about Maryland politics at politicalmaryland.com. You can also find his column at Center Maryland and marylandreporter.com. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone. Stay tuned. We've got more coming up here. When we get back, we're going to meet Charlie Carter, executive director of a new political organization, Maryland Working Families, that wants to mobilize, recruit, and elect more progressives in this state. Coming up in the second hour of Midday Friday, Mayim Bialik cooks. She plays Dr. Amy Farrah Fowler on CBS's The Big Bang Theory. Mayim Bialik joins me and John Shields of Gertrude's Restaurant to share recipes for vegans, or even vegetarians, or even meat eaters who like veggies. All are welcome. Midday Eats Big Bang Veggies after the news at 1. Before we speak with Charlie Carter, let me slip in a couple of more calls here. Alan in Timonium, a comment about the gubernatorial debate. Go right ahead, Alan.
Oh, hi, Dan. I am a member of the local Democratic group, the Central Baltimore County Democratic Committee, and I was lucky enough to actually be at the debate live, and also lucky enough that, in our campaign invitees at the membership, I've seen all three of them. And there is no contest. I came with an open mind when I saw all three candidates in a forum on separate dates, of course. And Heather Mazier was by far the most intelligent, had the most innovative solutions, the most detailed solutions, and spent the most time answering questions and without fear of being asked something that she wasn't prepared to answer. Anthony Brown had somebody who was actually picking the people asking the questions. He had a man named David Kosak, who I think works for Ken Ullman, who did at least at that time. And he was picking the people asking the questions. He knew that I had posted some not so positive things about Anthony Brown on Facebook, and he consistently looked into my eyes and chose somebody else to ask the question.
All right. So you're a supporter of Mazeer even going into the debate, right?
I was. I can't claim to be, undecided.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's go to Jason in Reisterstown. Jason wanted to make a comment about the John Carden situation. Go right ahead, Jason.
Yeah, I guess this is kind of a minority report, but I think you guys are probably being too hard on him. I mean, you look at all the things these guys have to do at a given moment. They're scheduled for three or four things at the same time. They have to do triage and pick where it's important for them to actually be, and where they simply have to put in their stamp. I think the fact that he could miss 75% of his votes and have that not matter at all in terms of the way our government runs is, I think, an indictment of what it means to be in a one-party state. And so I'll be fascinated to hear your next guest talk about how Maryland needs to be even more liberal than it is.
Okay. Let me read from reporter Jenna Johnson's story in Tuesday's Washington Post. Quote, as the Maryland activists celebrated their successful fight to increase the minimum wage, they realized something. This was way too much work, especially in a strongly liberal state where there is wide support for economic and social change. In a state as progressive as Maryland, we frequently don't see the progressiveness reflected in our elected officials. That's a quote from Gustavo Torres, president of CASA in Action, which advocates for immigrant communities. Quote, we can face our greatest challenges from those who are supposed to be standing with us. In other words, with Democrats like these eagerly voting for another tax break for millionaires while begrudgingly raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour by 2018, who needs Republicans? That's the question a lot of Maryland progressives asked. Some of them have now formed a new organization. It's called Maryland Working Families, an offshoot of the New York-based Working Families Party that was key in rallying voters to elect New York Mayor Bill de Blasio a few months ago. The executive director is Charlie Carter, and she's in the studio with us now. Charlie Carter, nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you, too.
You actually want Maryland to be more liberal? You don't think Maryland's liberal enough? You heard the last caller.
I did hear the last caller, and I also listened to the callers beforehand. And we have a problem in this state, and that is that there are leaders who aren't necessarily responsive or to the needs and aspirations and priorities of working people in this state, and that's a problem, and that's why Maryland Working Families is around. Our official kickoff was on Monday, but we've actually been around for the past 18 months as the driving force behind the Raise Maryland campaign.
And Raise Maryland was to raise the minimum wage.
Was to raise the minimum wage.
Now, I mentioned a 10-10 an hour. It's no secret I've written a column about that, thinking it inadequate, that why would it take 4 years to implement, to get us to a minimum wage that even the Labor Department, I think, indicates is what the wage should be now, not 4 years from now.
Exactly.
It makes it virtually meaningless. I know you feel that way. We agree on that. But well, is that what motivated you to start a new organization?
Well, the fact of the matter is I've been in Maryland for the last almost 10 years working in the General Assembly to advance the issues of working people. And quite often when you get to Annapolis, you run into a roadblock. And that is where people who are elected to represent workers, say in Baltimore City, will tell you, well, I can't really do that because it's of some fear that it's going to harm business when there is no evidence that it will, in fact, harm business. So that's why Maryland Working Families came into being, because in a state that calls itself progressive, we can pass a $100 million a year tax cut for the richest 3% with lightning quickness, but drag our feet on actually raising the minimum wage by $3 an hour for the lowest.
That's
paid
a reference
people.
To the estate tax cut that was added this year in the
Absolutely.
Legislature. What do you say to people, though? Because we keep hearing this refrain that Maryland is not friendly to business, that we are, you know, losing tax dollars and revenue in Maryland because businesses are fleeing the state and millionaires are fleeing the state to retire elsewhere?
Well, I think that there have been years of research that prove that millionaires aren't leaving the state, that in fact the decline in millionaires has more to do with a decline with the overall economy than with anyone fleeing the state of Maryland. I think the problem is Maryland is one of the wealthiest states in the country, and their business is flocking here to sell to our consumers and our citizens, and there should be responsibility associated with that.
Tell us a little bit about what got you to Maryland Working Families. I make this reference to the Working Families Party in New York City. So was there actually a connection, organizationally a connection?
Yes, we're actually affiliated with the National Working Families Organization. And we are following the model of the national organization, which isn't a party everywhere. In New York, they are. And they've been very successful in identifying, recruiting, training, and electing candidates that are the voice of the people.
Now, what will you be doing this year? I know mobilizing, because that was what you started off doing this week. Recruiting and electing more progressives to office in Maryland? Is that your plan?
Yeah, well, we have endorsed in a few of the state house races around the state.
The legislative races.
Legislative races.
Will you be endorsing in the gubernatorial and attorney general?
We will not be making statewide endorsements this year. Our focus is really on building local movements in communities where we have the ability to really make an impact on the legislature by electing strong, you know, worker ethic candidates that can be a voice for working people.
And what do you want? When you keep saying voice for working people, you know, a lot of us have an instinct about what that means. Beyond the minimum wage, what does it mean?
Well, it means implementing policies that make working families have economic success. I think that that's where we have great social progress in the state, but it really is a two Marylands when it comes to economic stability for people, regular working people and the wealthy.
What do you say to the person who says, oh, wait a minute, you know, if you reduce taxes a little bit more, make the state more business friendly, maybe I'll create some more jobs. That'll help working families.
Well, Maryland has reduced taxes on businesses in this state. They've cut, as in this year with the estate tax, cut taxes on the wealthy. But it's not trickling down. And what we need are priorities and policies that will help people succeed and rise up. Things like paid sick days. Everybody, I heard this whole discussion about John Carton. There are many, many working people who, when their child is sick or when they are sick, cannot afford to stay home and miss 75% of the work that they're supposed to do. But we could have policies in this state like they do in other states where you know, if you're sick, you can stay home and not worry about losing your job and actually be paid for it.
Who's joining Maryland Working Families? I mean, you put together a coalition to get the thing started. I mentioned Gustavo Torres, of course, who runs Casa de Maryland. Who else?
Well, we have some of our backers are some of the most active political players in the state. We have labor. We have civil rights organizations like Casa de Maryland. We have community organizers like Communities United. We have labor unions like AFSCME and 1199 who are all supporting us.
So you're saying to candidates who are progressives, who can prove they're progressives or liberal bona fides to you, if you want to run for office, we'll support you.
Yeah, if you want to run for
legislative office this year,
we'll support you. And our goal is to create a leadership pipeline of progressive leaders, but more importantly, to create the mechanism by engaging citizens to keep them accountable, because that really is where there seems to be a disconnect.
Charlie Carter is a new executive director of this new organization, Maryland Working Families. We'll get you back on the air another day to talk some more about it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Charlie. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And thanks for tuning into this first hour of Midday Friday, folks. We'll take a break now for lunch, brought to us every Friday by the good people over at Joe's Squared Pizza. Delicious pizza for our guests and our staff here on Fridays. Joe's Squared Pizza. Thank you very much. A short break coming up. We got the news from NPR and then the second hour of our show, and it's Celebrity Midday Eats coming up in our second hour.